Well, my thanks to Paul and my fellow panelists, to the officers of the Philadelphia Society, and to Bill for inviting me here to speak today. As I was preparing these remarks, I ran into a bit of a Protestant dilemma. You see, I was raised as a Lutheran and a German, so that told me I should stay within my time limits. But now I'm a Presbyterian in the Scottish tradition, so I felt a strong desire to write a lengthy treatise. So I've decided to resolve this by giving Bill a lengthier set of remarks for the website. And of course, the first rule of show business is always leave them wanting more. So I'll also call on my capitalist work ethic and refer you to my book, Politics Reformed. Well, speaking of books, if you pay attention to the book lists, you've noticed that Americans enjoy looking for their lost founders. And lately, the only thing better than being a remembered founder is being a lost founder. Lately, John Winthrop and George Mason have been described in recent books as forgotten founders, and some of our Philadelphia Society members and fellow travelers have recently written on forgotten founders. If you take a tour of Constitution Hall down the street, some park ranger will likely tell you, as they told us last time I was there, that the Iroquois are forgotten founders. And my wife told me I should remove any snide remarks that I originally wrote following that. Okay. Well, why bother with all this talk of recent centuries anno domini? According to a recent bestseller by Bruce Feiler, in fact, Bill turned me on to this book, Americans should recall Moses, he of the 16th century BC, as a neglected American founder and prophet. Now, Feiler has done something very American here in recalling Moses, and it is so very American to recall an ancient patriarch because it is so very Protestant, especially Reformed Protestant, and it is so Reformed Protestant because it is Hebraic. The Protestant reformers were not content to find their origins just in the early church or the apostolic age. They went back even further to the Hebrew patriarchs. Furthermore, Americans and Protestants are both revolutionaries, but revolutionaries in the tradition of ordered liberty. It is therefore not enough to recall recent memory, but to go back to the ancient past. From the earliest New England settlers through Martin Luther King, and even to the Bush Doctrine, Americans have seen themselves as children of Moses, as either liberators or liberated, and Americans are either following or leading an exodus. But while the earliest Protestants and Americans compared themselves to the children of Moses, perhaps a more important question is, are we children of Abraham? If you recall your scripture here, the covenant with Abraham was the foundation for the covenant with Moses, and it is the covenant with Abraham that makes for some very interesting political thinking. Let me cast this in terms of modern democratic politics. My wife warned me about this too, but I'm going to go with it. To be a child of Moses is a great comfort in times of oppression. Being children of Moses is kind of like being the party out of power. You can leave, or you can regain what you lost. To be a child of Abraham, however, is kind of like being the party in power. You can't just indict your oppressors or leave town. You actually have to make things happen. And if you recall the promise to Abraham in Genesis 22, Abraham is promised to have offspring as prolific as the sands on the seashore, to possess the seat of power, and to bless all the nations of the earth. That's pretty powerful stuff in terms of politics. To use the biblical terms, the children of Abraham are an elect and covenanted people, and you can trace this rhetoric of being a covenanted people, as I do in my book, from the continental Protestant reformers through Britain to the American colonies and to the founding. And in many ways, that stream of rhetoric continues today, but it's a very complicated rhetoric. What has this meant for American politics? There are many virtues that one can trace to the salutary influence of Reformed Protestantism in American politics, including its assertion to be children of Abraham. Let me articulate some of those and then list after that some of the vices which have come when Protestant politics went off the rails. Number one, the reformers were not fundamentalists in the worst sense. They were humanists in the best sense. They appreciated the classical tradition and secular learning and had a complementary view of reason and revelation. To read John Calvin or Samuel Rutherford is to understand that earthly things and heavenly things were different, and politics could be informed by earthly wisdom. This meant that biblical, classical, and early modern traditions could get along in the service of liberty. Now, this avoided a lot of confusion, the kind of confusion we see among pious folks in America today. Secondly, the Reformers read the Hebrew society to be a federal polity. It was decentralized, with layers of consenting authority. And if decentralization of power was good enough for the children of Abraham then, it's good enough for the children of Abraham now. Third, covenantal political theology emphasized community as more than the union of autonomous individuals. Americans understood rights not just as Paine or Jefferson described them, they also understood them as John Adams described them. And Adams, you may recall, went back to the Reformed Protestants, to Bishop Ponet, to John Milton, and to the Vindicii Contra Tyrannos. This implied an understanding of liberty that was both vertical and horizontal. As Winthrop put it, this was the difference between federal liberty being the freedom to govern yourself as you ought, and natural liberty, which Winthrop said was just the absence of restraint. Number four, perhaps the most important contribution of Reformed Protestantism was to have a clear view of the rights of conscience, to define tyranny in terms both secular and sacred, and to have a clear prescription for resistance. This is all on display in the American Revolution and founding and evidenced in numerous political sermons and pamphlets. Now, we do have to give the common law and the philosophers and the historians their due, but I don't think anyone did as much as the Reformed Protestant theology in inspiring the common man to resist in revolutionary America. You can see this on one of the battle standards, "We appeal to heaven." Fifth, finally, and perhaps most importantly, Reformed Protestantism drove home to Americans the corruption of human nature. It was not enough to simply have history and experience. That theological lens made a big difference. Well, so much for the virtues of Reformed Protestantism in American politics. Let me now suggest some of its vices. You see, being chosen, being the party of power, is not always easy. The covenant is a political symbol. And as Eric Voegelin said, political symbols become appropriated for pragmatic and messianic causes. Now, while the Protestants did learn some things from the political theory birthed by centuries of Christian political practice, they also convulsed those arrangements as they went. By the time the covenant reached America, especially after the English Revolution and the regicide, it was becoming increasingly confused. Americans were trying to sort out the relationship of church and state, as well as church membership, which in a way was kind of coterminous with citizenship. And this led to even more confusion. Americans were having a hard time figuring out how to be the children of Moses and the children of Abraham at the same time. Unfortunately, one of the ways of resolving this was to equate political faithfulness with religious faithfulness, and this opened the door for civil religion. By 1692, membership in the covenant was already coming to be associated with one's rights as an Englishman. Christian liberties were becoming the same as English liberties, or so said Cotton Mather, echoing the sentiments of his father, Increase Mather. By 1750 and 1766, Reverend Jonathan Mayhew can, without controversy, celebrate the 100th anniversary of the regicide, as well as the end of the Stamp Act, as if these were events on the church calendar. And Mayhew is, it was, of course, just a powerhouse when you look at the literature of the Revolution. Equating civil liberties with Christian liberties was popular outside of New England as well. Now, as I noted before, the Reformed Protestants were humanists, and so we shouldn't be surprised to see secular political theory and political theology blended together, especially in the liberal and republican traditions. And while it may warm our heart to think of a civil theology which defends liberty, we also have to ask what happens when civil theology swings back the other way. Now, I'm admittedly painting with a very broad brush here, and my point is only to explain how the colonial and revolutionary experience set a precedent. And so I'll leave the next three centuries of history to others and simply move on to some of the distortions that Americans read into being a covenanted people as civil religion became more widespread over three centuries. First, Americans, including many Protestants, began to confuse social and moral reform through the state with the work of God. At first, Reformed Protestant activism was largely directed toward recovering liberty. This is what John Bradshaw said at the Regicide. Disobedience to tyrants is obedience to God. And this was a well-established principle by the 17th century, and it was such a great principle that even Franklin and Jefferson could suggest this as the seal of the United States. But by the time of the 19th and 20th centuries, the political theology of America had drifted into the social gospel and progressivism. And Christian political action didn't mean the recovery of liberty, it began to mean the loss of liberty. The entrepreneurial minister became the ceaseless worker for the state. As higher criticism and the historical Jesus advanced, robbing the church of mystery, ministers began to fill the space with social work, prohibition, and the like. To do the work of the state now became to do the work of God. This continues today, as we see evangelicals. And if you watch American politics, right, the evangelicals are in play. Who can get the evangelicals? And too many of them, I think, are on board for all kinds of state-driven, tax-funded boondoggles, fantasies, and obstacles to liberty. Number two, politics becomes a messianic vision whose proponents see themselves as exempt from human nature and the lessons of history. This was one of the great contributions of Reformed Protestants, was this distrust of human nature, and I'm trying to figure out where it went. Reformed Protestantism has always wrestled with this problem, but it had built-in inhibitors to keep it from straying into fanaticism or millenarianism. But when American civil religion was constructed on Reformed Protestantism and secular ideology, variants of American exceptionalism, detached from its theological roots, it lost its inhibitions. The result was a belief that Americans had somehow become immune to the limits of human nature. And who else was left to fill that vacuum of left but the state? As Americans lost their imagination for liberty, they lost their distrust of power. And this has happened both in terms of domestic and foreign policy. Well, let me close with three points which I think will harken back to the virtues of Reformed Protestantism and its love of liberty. First, we must reconstruct the vocabulary of liberty and the institutions of liberty. These were alive and well in past centuries, in part because they were theological and moral imperatives. The Reformed Protestants had a broad vocabulary of liberty. It was at once theological, philosophical, historical, and legal. It was religious and secular. Read, for example, the Vindicii Contra Tyrannos or Samuel Rutherford's Lex Rex to see how the reformers drew on multiple traditions to stir an understanding of liberty. We must recover that vocabulary, use it, and pass it on to the next generation. And we must do this here and around the world. And in this rhetoric, we will regain our moral imagination of liberty. Number two, decentralize power. The irony of religion and politics in America is that so many Americans, especially Protestants, resist the parish model, church membership, and denominational affiliation. Why? They say, well, I want to make sure I'm free to worship God in any way I see fit. Then they run to the nearest federal bureaucracy or politician and beg them for a monopoly. Whatever happened to federalism founded on the biblical model? We must recover the desire for self-government and federal liberty. We must start asking ourselves why it is we trust human nature to turn over so much of our lives to people we don't even know, who reside in structures and institutions which do not distrust human nature as they should. I always find it funny when Americans say, I don't believe in the institutional church, but they believe in the institutional school, institutional retirement, institutional health care, and a whole host of other institutions. Number three, we must return to the lessons of community learned from Reformed Protestantism. Community is not unique to America, of course, and we can learn a lot from others, but coupled with our frontier spirit and work ethic, Americans once set an example for the world. We must regain community if we are to roll back the advance of bad government and restore individual responsibility. Now, if it's one thing that Reformed Protestants looked forward to, it was a good fight over something that mattered. In doing these three things, we may recover a liberty worth the name, liberty worth being jealous for, and liberty worth fighting for. Thank you.